Okay. I think we're going to finally get started. Sorry for the delay. We do have central AC in here, but Kevin wouldn't let us use it. So, to a point, nothing's been accomplished in 10,000 years. But sorry for putting up with the heat. We're actually working on more adequate air conditioning in the shop, but right now it's just in the front. So, I'm not going to talk for too long because I know we're late and I want to get them started. But this is going to be the first of a series of debates that we're going to have here, hopefully, just about, you know, relevant issues. This is our first, and so it's a great turnout. We really appreciate people taking time to come and sit in the swampy back room with us. We have Kevin Tucker and Alexis Buss. You can guess which side they're debating. And we do want this to be an interactive debate, so please feel free to ask questions, bring up your own points. This isn't just us listening to them all night. It's actually all of us taking part in meaningful discussion. So we're going to have them start off and just kind of introduce themselves and their philosophies, and then we will open it up to kind of everyone in a little bit. We'll probably stop serving food and drinks around 8 or a little after, so if you want one last thing, try and get around then. We're going to take a break right around 8 o'clock or a little after, and then we'll start back up in the last half hour or so. So, Kevin, you want to get started?
Hi, my name is Kevin Tucker, and I have to admit, I'm a former syndicalist. But I'm no longer. I've been a green anarchist for some time. Black and Green Press, Black and Green Network, all things I took part in. Species Trader is my publication. It's a book-sized journal published very irregularly. And, you know, I've taken part in Green Anarchy magazine, regularly contributed to it. But yeah, I really want to thank Dave, Mike, and everybody at the Grindcore House for making this happen. This is, you know, we have a lot of anarchist conferences, and there's a lot of times where you get a lot of the heated stuff. But for the most part, as far as sitting down and hashing it out, it's not something that happens a lot. And I think there's, you know, no false pretenses here in saying that we agree or that we intend to get to a point to that we agree to. It's, you know, realistically, what we want to do is say this is where we're coming from. This is the kind of ideas that we put out. At least, you know, that's what I'm saying. And this is why we come to that point. There's a lot of miscommunication, a lot of misunderstanding, and I mean, it's not that there's not a ton of differences. There really are. But we really want to just spell out, I think through the idea of the debates and everything, is to lay it out and say, this is where we're different, and this is why we are. And, you know, there's you know, it gets messy on both sides. But, you know, even in Northeastern Anarchists there a while ago, there was a letter in there that claimed that myself and John Zerzan and another anarcho-primitivist thinker were against human communication and human emotion and things like that, which were totally insane. So yeah, by all means, it's good to have this kind of like meshing out and really kind of pushing it out there. But I guess, you know, I assume most people here are probably at least generally familiar with anarchism. I think the point we would come together on and the point we would agree on is, you know, the very basis of anarchy, without state, without government. You know, what that means for all sides of anarchism are very different things. And all anarchists, you know, and there's nothing universal about it. But typically, a lot of anarchist theory goes back to, you know, red anarchism, industrial anarchism, the kind of syndicalist, anarcho-communist ideas. And that's generally what it's been attributed to over the past 100 or so years, 150 years. But where green anarchists and anarcho-primitivists more specifically have come off from that is coming through, especially with the 70s and the 60s and the 80s, all the new kind of information that was coming about, all the new struggles that were coming about in terms of ecological resistance, eco-feminism, deep ecology to certain degrees, and just a general understanding of colonialism, an advanced understanding of colonialism, the changing nature of industrial society into modernity. And it just kind of threw the light on a lot of issues about what the nature of power is, what the nature of the state is, what the nature of control is. And that's where things start to split. When we start to look at it from an ecological angle, we see that it's more than just about human control over other humans, or human control over other societies, or one society's control over another. It's about our relationship to this earth. And when you look at ecofeminism, I mean, you can see a lot about the nature of patriarchy and a lot about how things really formed about in terms of the creation of a patriarchal state and how that's contributed to the religious and economic and socio-political aspects of this society and the civilization. And what we came to is saying it's not just about the state. It's not just about government. These things came from somewhere, and that somewhere is civilization itself. most specifically agriculture. And that's kind of the anarcho-primitivist perspective. From a green anarchist perspective, largely anti-civilization, though not necessarily in full agreement about the nature of anarcho-primitivist critiques or the implications of anarcho-primitivist critiques about, you know, how far back we're looking in terms of where we diverted from what we see as this primal anarchy, this lived existence where we have, you know, going back tens to hundreds of thousands of years as Homo sapiens sapiens, living in small band societies that are inherently anarchistic, and not anarchistic in the sense that they thought out these aspects of societies and they had these elaborate philosophies or anything like that, but it's a simply functional anarchist society. And there's just so much to be learned from that, and that's what we're looking at. We're saying, how do we go from that point here to this point here? How do we go from that to these agrarian societies that are inherently patriarchal, religiously oriented, and domineering in all aspects, and you go through that to class society, and you go into that into all forms of industrial societies, and you end up now where you have this modernized industrial techno industrial mega machine, as we tend to call it. And you know, by looking at that, we can see this is where problems happen, this is where problems lie. And I think there's a lot of mischaracterization of anarcho-primitivism as an ideology, and that's something that's you know, a critique that's come about, and also because of the post-left anarchists, 60s, 70s, 80s, and things like that, and critiquing even the ultra-left, critiquing ideas of organization, critiquing ideas of ideology, critiquing the ideas of these rigid movements and rigid notions and platforms and things like that. And we're not sitting here trying to say, as, you know, when I say we, if I'm talking about anarcho-primitivism, but I'm speaking for myself and generally what I see of it. But the idea is not to say this is a singular critique. This is not a singular path of saying this is how things happened and this is how things are going down and this is what's inevitably ending. This is the path that we're going to take as a society organized to recreate it. The anarcho-primitivism is a critique, and it's a critique that has a lot of implications, and it's a critique that's rooted in the traditional anarchist ideas of saying no gods, no masters, and expanding that to say gods and masters are expansion of control. And where do these things come from? And we're not simply saying that, you know, we need to look at hunter-gatherer societies, nomadic-gatherer-hunter societies, and say this is a blueprint for how we must live. That we need to look at people living in sub-Saharan Africa and say that there's a blueprint about that society we have to recreate. What we're saying is, and essentially my basic point is that what we're seeing throughout history, what we're seeing throughout the world, are that humans respond the same way to similar circumstances. And that everything about civilization, everything about domestication, everything about the nature of the state, the nature of power, isn't just trying to create new ideas about how we should interact. It's not about creating needs and creating desires. It's about channeling the needs and desires we have as human beings, as animals, as wild beings that are being contrived and pushed into this domestication system that requires domestication constantly. And all the things that traditional anarchists critique, even leftists, everything critique, about the nature of media, the nature of control, the nature of productionism, the nature of material comforts and needs that have been created. It's not so much that we're saying these things have been created as we're saying this is the way that we've been taken apart. This is the way that as a community, as human beings with needs, our needs have been converted and diverted so that we keep looking at this different thing. We keep looking towards this arching idea of human progress that throughout the past 10,000 years that there has been massive change that is positive and that there is an end goal and that we're going to achieve something better than what there always was. And it's something we just, you know, when you look at it, what we've lost, when you looked at how these societies function and you look at the methods of control used to keep them from popping up and when you look at the methods of control and destruction used to impact one civilization upon a non-civilized society or a non-civilized area, it's just ludicrous. I mean, we see that we had, as humans, as a wildness, we had everything we need, and that this has all been channeled. And implicit in that is critiques of technology as something that's been moved along the way. But now I'm going to open it up, but or I'll also say civilization, as I'm referring to it, is defining as literally the word civilization within cities. So, the culture of cities. So we're not just talking about cities. We're talking about the farmlands that are necessary, the agricultural societies that are necessary, an accessory. Yeah, it's hot. To creating and keeping that civility alive, and the mental institutions, the physical institutions that create and recreate that society. And as green anarchists, we say civilization is our target. That is the thing that we were opposed to 100%. Anarcho-primitivists, what we're interested in doing is looking further back in the origins, of looking back at how things have changed between nomadic gather-hunter societies, settled gather-hunter societies, and horticultural societies, and seeing how each level of change, each level of domestication, each bit that some level of civilization has kind of crept in has channeled that control and channeled that and channeled what it means to be human and how that society has existed. And, you know, we're not saying that everything that's happened since nomadic gather-hunters have, you know, been conquered by the first horticultural neighbors is a damnation and therefore an enemy of ours. We're simply saying this is a critique, and that this is, you know, I'm not saying horticulturalists by any means my enemy, even though I, you know, I think there's more to be said about nomadic gather-hunter life. I'm not making implicit statements about values on what is happening within horticultural societies. I think there's issues with in a philosophical sense, and understanding the implications of how domestication crept in and the implications of domestication within those societies. But we're simply saying, as anarchists, if we're going to be talking about, you know, what we can be doing and how things can be going, it makes the most sense to look at the societies that did function as anarchistic societies without control, without meetings, without all this, you know, without platforms, and say, what happened here that made it work so well that was being lost along the way?
Hi, everybody. So, I think it is somewhat of a difficult thing to say syndicalism versus primitivism, in that it's kind of apples and oranges here. But I'm going to, I think for the sake of an interesting discussion, I'm just going to punch Kevin in the face. No. I would never do that. I'm going to talk a little bit more about understanding power structures and how to dismantle them, and take what I would say would be consistent with the syndicalist approach, but I don't want to have this like notion that primitivism and syndicalism are somehow like competing ideologies with each other. It's really not. We're so off the radar from what each other are doing. It's just like, I don't know. There we go. My lived experience in organizing has largely been in labor organizing. And labor organizing, like community organizing, or a lot of the stuff that I'd say maybe Kevin would call like your classic anarchism, is mass organizing. Organizing people to act together to fight the power that oppresses them. My own introduction to syndicalism has been largely through the IWW. I joined when I was right out of high school. I was a printing press operator. I worked in a shop where I smashed my thumb to bits. Our boss paid us with bouncing paychecks and so on. We eventually decided we would just simply take over the shop, open up an escrow account, decide what we were going to pay ourselves, what work we took in, and so on, and basically took the thing over from our boss. Didn't last very long, of course, but it was a very liberating experience, and one that kind of has forever changed my idea about being a working person and what it means to work for a boss. And I think that the lesson that I took away from that was that by organizing with my coworkers, a lot of the paradigm that I think a lot of the labor movement gets into, us being on the far left of the labor movement, is, you know, when you're in a regular union or you talk about union issues, so many times it's kind of boring in terms of revolutionary perspective. Yeah. Are you going to make 5 cents more an hour? Are you going to have 10 sick days or 8 sick days or so on? But those bread and butter issues do have a real potential to ask people to expand their thinking and engage in a struggle. And when you engage in that kind of struggle, I think it does open up possibilities for asking questions about power relations and so on, and ordinary people finding answers to those problems together. And honestly, I find a lot of the ideas of about wilderness and so on very appealing myself. I like foraging for blueberries. Like, I enjoy identifying mushrooms. But I also think, you know, cupcakes are also really fucking delicious. So presents a certain problem for me. I feel like the problem that I have as an anarchist a lot of times is that I'm a very impatient person. I think, well, I could handle an issue in a very expeditious way myself. There'll never be a movement to tackle these things. And in my more impatient moments, there'll never be a movement that can tackle these things. So I'm going to go act myself and do something out of the pages of Green Anarchy to solve a problem that I perceive. The problem, I think, and I think I'm going to call that insurrectionism, okay? I mean, these solitary, somewhat alienated acts that I'd say is the opposite of mass movement building to solve an issue. And I think that that's where I would draw the, if there's going to be a debate, it seems to me like that's really the concerns that I have when I get a copy of Green Anarchy is operationalizing these, you know, the love of wilderness and so on. I'm not really seeing how you get from insurrectionist acts to unringing the bell of civilization and going back to primitive culture. So it's not so much why we ended up from a primitive state to this bad situation we're in now, but, you know, with syndicalism, the idea is workers have control of their workplaces. Workers have power. Communities have the ability to say, this is the kind of work we want to do to make our lives. I think you just need to leave. She's not bothering me. Okay. sorry, my daughter is very clingy because it's very fun. Now I've totally lost my my point. Something about workers' power. Anyway, you know, it's not, but it can't just be about workers controlling their workplaces. That's probably not enough. And being oppressed as workers is not the only oppression that's out there in the world. All kinds of communities need to build their power. And I guess what I'd say about it is that the most successful and lasting examples that I see, certainly the most inspirational examples that I see of people challenging that power, comes from mass movements. I really love the story of the Builders Laborers Federation. They happened in the 70s. It was an Australian union. And sometimes I think, when I read criticisms of unions or syndicalism from Green Anarchy, the pages of Green Anarchy, what I take away is like kind of like a cogent argument, if you wanted to go down that line, would be, workers organizing just keeps you spinning the wheels of industrialization. Workers will never organize to put themselves out of work, you know. But this, I can give you a million examples, but I really love this one particular example, so I'm going to give it to you. This union called the Builders Laborers Federation is an industrial union of construction workers. The unfortunate reality is that most of our construction unions are job preservation societies for white guys, and are very, very conservative, and often do things, crappy things, like fight for more funding for prisons when they could just as easily fight for schools, because they want to build prisons, and not, you know, when they could be building schools. they don't take control of their labor and say, hey, we're the people that make this stuff, and here's the stuff we're going to make. But in the 70s, this really excellent union, the BLF, said they started off demanding, they started off with a demand, joining a demand for better workers' comp laws. So if you're hurt on the job, how does that happen? Right? How does the state deal with the fact that you're an injured worker? And the government said to the BLF, to that union, we'll give you a special law so that if a construction worker gets hurt, you'll get, you know, 10 more days a year. And they said, no, we want it for everybody. They actually won that struggle. But they got a taste of power. This was through massive strikes, massive street actions. No construction was getting done. And simultaneous to this struggle, there was a park. This is in Sydney, Australia. Sydney was going through a major construction boom. And this park was about to be the last kind of green space in Sydney. And the powers that be wanted to put a big skyscraper there. And the BLF was like, all right. But it was actually in a middle-class neighborhood. And this middle-class association was like, we want our green space. And they went to the BLF. And initially, their response was, fuck you, you middle-class assholes. You know, well, upper-middle-class assholes. You don't know what it's like to be a construction worker, to be suffering from lack of jobs and so on. But some, upon consideration, they decided, hey, if this park goes, we also can't enjoy it. And other people can't enjoy it. So they started what was then called the Green Bans. And they would not build on any more green areas. Well, then they started seeing their own neighborhoods, which were more working class neighborhoods, get plowed under for gentrification in the wake of this development in Sydney, and there's only so many places it could go. So they then said, you know what, we're also not going to build in any working class neighborhoods. We're not going to tear down any more working class neighborhoods for gentrification. You're either going to settle up and do right by the people who live there, or no. And then pretty soon, they just got all full of themselves, got very uppity as workers. And I read this excellent book, Green Bans, Red Union. And I just love this union. The queer kids on campus couldn't get their queer kids organization chartered. And they were like, BLF, the university will not charter our gay and lesbian club. What can we do? And they said, have no fear. We will not build anything for your university until they charter the Gay and Lesbian Kids Club. Like, are you kidding me? You know, you gotta love these guys. So, and they would they had cranes, and they would let people drop banners from their cranes. Like, anyway, this book will blow your mind. I'm sorry to go on about it. I just started rereading it the other day. And so, Green Bands, Red Unions by Verity Bergman. But anyway, I know that that's not, and sad to say, the union didn't last either, but it does give me a whole lot of hope that people who are doing work aren't necessarily always going to pick the most expeditious thing for them to put more money in their pocket. It is very possible to cultivate the sense of the greater good and ask people to use their labor and their strength as workers, their power as workers and as wealth producers to make the world better. And I'm hopeful for that happening. And it saddens me to think that we could instead decide, well, the collapse of civilization is upon us. Some of us are going to live, but most of us are going to die. Because I feel like I know who's going to die. And it's not going to be, well, the people who live aren't going to be us. And they're not going to be our neighbors. And they're certainly not going to be our coworkers. I think capitalism is a very, very resilient power system. And that the people who have the wealth will do anything should that collapse be. So, yeah, I think I want to make an argument for hope and working together to resolve problems and confront power and create an equal society. So there you go. There's my spiel.
Well, there's a lot of jump off points there.
Okay.
Do you have a favorite?
We get to go where we could take comments or questions or...
Either or. I'm open
Where's
either or.
Dave? Dave, how does this work here? How's your operation go?
Kevin, do you want to respond to any of what she said as far as based on what you were talking about earlier?
Yeah, okay. All right, so, I mean, there's a lot of stuff in there. And I guess that, you know, maybe it's ironic. I spend most of my time working at in print factories. I've had a lot of the same kind of experience, and I've had bosses churn equipment up on me to the point where I almost lost limbs. And, I mean, my general response at the time was just try to fight them. That kind of got my way for a little while. But, I mean, it's just, I guess going back further, my real issue, what made me move away from syndicalism completely is the fact that for many years that I was a syndicalist, I had a kind of confused sense of what I considered syndicalism. I was trying to rectify ideas of animal liberation, earth liberation. I was deeply involved with indigenous resistance groups. I grew up in St. Louis, which is the hometown of Monsanto. I was there, like, you know, I was a syndicalist at the time when GMO seeds were really being unleashed into the field, unleashed into the market, and living in this locus of just insanity, of what I at the time would have considered capitalist gone wild. Like, this is just the seedbed of depravity as far as what people will do for money. And, I mean, you had the headquarters of Peabody Coal, which were denuding Dene tribal and ancestral sacred lands, and I was working with them, and I had the Ogoni people, who Kentaro Wiwa and eight other people involved with most of the Ogoni resistance against shale oil drilling on their land, had actually moved to St. Louis, and that was at that point the center of campaigns against shale. And I was involved in all these things, and all at the same time living in the area which had the greatest suburban expansion of any area in the United States for years and then. And this is way ahead of its time in some regards, and it was disgusting. I mean, places that I had played in as a kid, woods I had loved to be in as a kid, I literally watched on a daily basis being torn down. And amidst all that, amidst trying to take part in these ecologically oriented resistance movements, you know, trying to get a better understanding of ecofeminism and its implications, it's just really, when I looked at it, I said, there's something not right here. And to me, that was the industrial civilization. That was the problem. I mean, that was the inherent thing that tied all these things together. You have oil extraction, you have coal mining extraction, you have GMO seeds, all these things used to feed a dying civilization. And the most ironic part about it is that the area I lived in was actually where the Cahokia Indians used to go to get flint to make their blades and things like that. And it was right across the river from the Cahokia Mounds, which were a place I used to love to go before I put any thought to it at all. But it was this abandoned civilization in this area that had some of the highest rates of various lung disorders and things like that, cancers, all because of the entire Mississippi River there and Missouri Rivers in those areas are filled with oil refineries. And there was just the common thread throughout all this is just being in the middle of this dying civilization on the land of a dead civilization and filled with the inhabitants and people trying to save themselves from that civilization. And, I mean, I got into things, too. I had, like, I got into anarchism in part through bands like the anarcho-punk bands, things like Crass. And it never sat right with me that Crass, their final gig, was a benefit for striking miners. And that really was where I drew the line. I can't say, I mean, the idea of supporting workers or supporting struggles, and by no means am I saying that, you know, worker struggles aren't a part of the history of civilization, the history of people trying to oppose the people who are forcing domestication upon them, and trying within the context of their society, within the context of their lives, to fight for what they believed was going to be their means to liberty, the means to build community, the means to take back what the process of domestication had taken from them. But it's all contextual. And that's, when you look at it in the grand picture, it's all contextual and it's all there. And it gets to a point where I can't say I support worker struggles, because what am I going to do? Am I going to say, you know, the people who are tearing down all these areas that I grew up in, that I loved, and I know other people loved, and animals lived in, and you know, and then the same thing for areas that are being torn down for gentrification. If those people were going to strike, could I say that there's an implicit value on their rights as workers over the right of wildness to exist, or over the right of this continued onslaught of civilization continue happening? And you can't separate civilization, you cannot separate industrialism or agrarianism from conquering, from colonization, from colonialism and expansion.